Okay, a very good evening to you, one and all, LSE community, I suppose. Thank you very much for coming this evening. My name is Tony Travers. I am director of the Greater London Group, which is a research centre based in the government and geography departments here at the school. And I'm here merely to facilitate this evening, though actually the first thing I'm going to say is the usual postmodern, please switch off your mobile phones or leave only things that hum and buzz rather than squeak, perhaps, if you would. Thank you very much. I'm here to chair this evening's event, which is a sort of cross between a debate and a sort of question time event. That means that we will have short presentations from each of four speakers who have a range of quite different views on the subject under debate, which is public-private partnerships. And then you will very much have an opportunity either to make what I hope will be short, sharp contributions, or indeed to ask questions of particular panelists. So as ever, I would like to make this as interactive as possible. That's a warning to my colleague speakers here to keep their contributions to a sort of 5-minute maximum, which means that we should then have at least 3/4 of an hour before we can drift upstairs for a drink. So, and the way I've agreed with my four colleagues to do this is that we will have a speaker who's broadly in favour of public-private partnerships and presumably therefore sees them as a short and long-term salvation. And then we'll have one speaker who is more sceptical. Amanda, sitting here, is going to speak first. Bob will speak second. And then another pro, and then finally Alison, who is broadly anti. So there'll be a sort of sense of a debate, but not too much of one. It's very much an informal evening. Now, our first speaker is Amanda McIntyre, who is the head of modernising government at the Confederation of British Industry. I've known Amanda for many years, as they say, as she's worked at the CBI for a number of years. And the CBI, I know, has a strong policy position about the involvement of private capital and private expertise in public sector type capital investments. And Amanda, perhaps I can ask you to kick off this evening and set the scene for us.
Thanks. If I stand up, can you still hear me? Yeah? Great.
Yes, and in fact, thank you for a warning. If anybody can't hear at any point, please say, and we'll do something about it. Thanks.
The gist of the issue for the CBI is that the challenge to improve public services is huge. And we're only going to meet that challenge if we involve the best of the public and the private and the voluntary sector working together. We read every day that the challenge is huge, but just as an example, last September, the Local Government Association conducted a survey asking the public and the business community and also local authority people and health people about whether public services were likely to improve. And the question was, you know, in the next 4 years, if current trends continue, will services get better? And 100% of councils said yes. 90% of health authorities said yes. But only 35% of the public and 31% of the business community agreed. So clearly there are very high expectations and clearly real challenges. We are absolutely not of the view that this is about private good, public bad. And that kind of language is as damaging as the opposite of extreme of public good, private bad. It's really about making sure that you have the best of all sectors working together in the best possible way. And actually, public-private partnerships are about trying to get them to work together in the best possible way. If you look back at some of the dreadful tendering of the past, what you saw was short-term contracts, bargain basement shopping, often at the expense of workers' terms and conditions, and certainly at the expense of service quality. You also saw situations where the initial capital investment was made. We had the new school or the new road, but there was nothing put into maintenance. And these problems have caused real damage to economy, society, and individuals. And public-private partnerships are about trying to get the public and private sectors to work together in a different way. They're about teamwork between the public and the private, but they're also about teamwork within the private sector. So the idea of getting the design and the build and the capital finance and the service operators to team up and come up with a single solution means that you do get prisons that are designed with enough space for prisoners to work all day instead of being locked in their cells. You do get much better attention to long-term maintenance and a much more whole life value for money approach than you used to get in the past. The rationale, of course, for PPPs at the outset was all about getting assets off the government's balance sheet, because poor old public procurement was pretty dull in those days. It was the role of paperclip people. And there wasn't really much understanding of the importance of public procurement, just like there wasn't really much recognition of the importance of better procurement in the private sector. But things are changing. I'm not saying everything's perfect, but there are lots and lots of examples of projects that are delivering results for the public. If you ask yourself what's still in the way, well, I think the rationale still isn't very well understood, because the issues are quite technical. And there is a responsibility on all of us, I think, to explain how PPPs work, to explain the successes, but also to explain why things haven't gone well in the past. Perhaps they haven't gone well because the right PPP model wasn't used. Perhaps they haven't gone well because there hasn't been enough skill on the ground. And also, it's fair to say that both the public and the private sectors need to get better at explaining all the kind of characteristics of successful projects. They haven't been very good at selling themselves. It's clearly important that we continue our work to improve the handling of all the people issues in PPPs, because actually, if PPPs are about improving public services, they're fundamentally about better people management. And we've done a lot of work with the unions, although you might not see it from the press coverage. We've done a lot of work with the unions and the government to make sure that PPPs are about better handling of workforce issues. You know, you had the CBI and the TUC and the LGA campaigning for legislation on this, campaigning for guidance on this, saying that it's vital that when you have a PPP, the contract should only go to companies with really excellent people management track records, and that public sector clients ought to be very skilled at spotting the best client and the best people manager. There fundamentally are challenges for the government as a client. And I think if you think about public policy, how we make PPPs work is not just so much about getting the policy right and getting the initiatives right, it's about getting the skills right on the ground. And that challenge is huge. And it's not going to be achieved through kind of central finger wagging or legislation. It's only going to work when we have widespread commitment on the ground and really skilled public sector managers and clients and really skilled private and voluntary sector partners working together to deliver better public services.
Right, thank you very much, Amanda. I should have said at the beginning, of course, the extent and development of PPPs and PFI-type projects is not new and certainly not unique to the present government, though they have expanded enormously under the present administration since 1997, not least within Greater London, where the biggest of all PPPs is tottering on the brink of being signed. That's the PPP for the Underground. And our next speaker, although not explicitly going to speak about that, is a member of the elected Democratic Government for London. Bob Neil, sitting here on my right, appropriately enough, is the Conservative leader on the Assembly, the London Assembly, which is a component part of the GLA. And indeed, I think it's fair to say Bob is, in a sense, what keeps our council tax down when Ken Livingstone's trying to put it up. So perhaps I can ask him now to speak with a slightly more sceptical tone about PPP-PFI.
Well, Thanks very much, Tony. I'm very glad of you to sit me on the inside right, just for avoidance of any doubt. And it was nice to come along as the only alumnus who's actually speaking tonight. And I thought I ought to think, as I'm sitting here, how familiar this was. And, of course, it wasn't really at all, which says something, perhaps, about how little time I probably spelt in lectures in this theatre. And that, in turn, explains why some LSE lawyers end up like Tony Grabiner and others end up like Ken Livingston Shadow. But there it is. There's a moral tale there for everybody as far as that's concerned. But you're right, I'm not being equivocal simply because I'm a politician. I actually do genuinely think that PPP has been something of a curate's egg. I don't have a problem with the idea in principle. And the points that have been made I wouldn't, in essence, disagree with. But subject to some caveats, it does seem to me that we do certainly need to have a greater diversity in the way in which we procure public services. That's not a problem. That's particularly true of big projects. It's also true that in the right type of PPP, or indeed PFI deal, the private sector expertise in actual delivery of services is particularly worthwhile. I think we are succeeding slowly in changing the culture in the public sector and in local government in particular, as far as service delivery, as far as our clients is concerned. But I frankly don't think that would have been possible to the degree it is being without that degree of pressure from the ability to do PPP or PFI deals. And having been involved in some of the very early, and I accept by comparison, quite crude attempts at contracting out, nonetheless, that was, I think, a very necessary adding of yeast, if you like, into the pot, which then produced some desirable effects. And I can certainly think of some within London which have worked well. Vehicle maintenance that we do with the London and Fire and Emergency Planning Authority, which I'm a member of, has been very successful. I think generally accepted as working well. We're looking to do some of those things, perhaps as far as the property portfolio is concerned, because there's sense in rationalising those areas. I certainly think that there are areas within health and education in which the work can be done. The police force has, I think, yet fully to get to grips with it. But for those of us who, and Tony will know this, who have to cope on an annual basis with the yawning lack of accountability in the immensely bureaucratic and rigid structures that we inherited from the Home Office with the Met Police as far as both budgeting and procurement is concerned, I'm sure that there are real areas there. But what you don't do is to tie it sometimes into some of the contracts that we have seen, some contracts which are so rigid that we discovered it was costing you about £180 to go and replace a kettle. You know, that's exactly those type of old-style, rather crude systems which rather damage the argument. And the obvious flagship within London of the Tube does seem to me to be exactly not the sort of way to do a PPP. I don't say that a public-private involvement isn't appropriate for the Tube, but what I don't see the logic of is, A, how there is a genuine transference of risk as far as the Tube's own particular arrangement is concerned, given the way the contracts are so structured, so long-term. I know there's got to be some length to get the funding in, but when it's so long-term that the risk, it seems to me, and you actually get me agreeing with Ken Livingstone on this point, is pretty minimal. So it defeats, I think, one of the key objects. The transference of risk has to be absolutely genuine, and secondly, it has to be transparent as well, because of the public interest in that matter. And secondly, I must say, I don't think it's the way round to have done it. Firstly, I don't think it was actually necessary to split the operation of trains from track to procure that particular thing. That's a technical argument. I don't think it was necessary. I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the market would have been interested in it being done actually as one system. Secondly, alternatively, you could, of course, have done it through discrete lines with operation and infrastructure being done together. But it does seem to me odd that the system we have doesn't seem to me to meet the transference of risk requirements as far as the infrastructure procurement is concerned. But equally and ironically, it leaves the actual service delivery, the very area at which generally the private sector has the best and most innovative ideas, the interface with customers, the person end of the business, that's left in a monopolistic public sector situation. So you have a very traditional management, potentially, at TfL and a monopoly trade union. That doesn't seem to me that was the right way round to have done it. and that we could have done a great deal of good with bringing in private sector skills into the actual running of the railroad aspect of the operation. So that's why it seems to me that the argument is something of a curate's egg. The right form of contract can bring benefits, but it shouldn't be regarded, as I fear it is increasingly being regarded at the moment, particularly under the present climate, as a sort of a panacea for all things. There are failings, and we have to be alert to that. And I think the final point I'd make is that there is a danger that the Treasury's fondness for PPPs disguises a separate, very important debate we ought to be having, which I, for want of a bit of shorthand, would tend to call fiscal devolution within the UK. And that is that the dead hand of the Treasury still ultimately governs virtually everything in terms of major public procurement in the UK. I see some Treasury folk here as I looked at the crib sheet beforehand, so apologies on a personal basis. But it's very interesting when you are getting such a consensus of comments about that coming from politicians not just in London, but almost any politician who's outside Westminster, if I can put it that way, right across the political spectrum. From left to right, that there's something that needs to be addressed here, because at the moment people tend to be inevitably using PPPs and PFIs in local government to procure major projects, because we don't have the power to do what virtually every other forms of city or regional governance everywhere else in the world do, which is actually to have a much freer hand to raise our own capital against revenues that we generate. And I think we would be wrong if we allowed ourselves to forget that debate in response to the short-term attractions of the PPP, which has its role, but equally will not give us a long-term fix to the means of actually making sure that particularly big cities, but it applies elsewhere, that regional and city governance in the UK actually has a means of raising its own money, going for bonds if appropriate or other means to the market. And that must in turn involve us looking at the whole local government financial settlement in the UK. People always used, my friends in France always talk about the Jacobin state. Actually think we are probably closer to that in the UK now, something that my own party played a part in, I accept, during the 80s, but that's been reinforced under the stewardship of the present government. And I think that's the other debate that we're not having and that we ought to have. So that's why I have that very much curate's and egg view of the PPP situation.
Thank you very much, Bob. Clearly, whoever wins power in elections, the Treasury always gets back in, as we all know. Right, and our third speaker, who is going to take, a slightly more enthusiastic view about private finance and PPPs, is Charles Cox, who is responsible now at EDS for government and healthcare business and has been much involved at the CBI with promoting the development of private finance and private finance projects through the CBI, I think. So, Charles.
I think this is going to be an easy evening for me, because I didn't come here to actually kind of promote any one position. I'm not a theologian on this subject, and I'm here really as a practitioner and with a practitioner set of views. But having listened to the last speaker, I think we're all going to... the views are so converged around this, as I think it will make your summing up perhaps quite an easy job, but there's one
wait
more speaker,
see,
so let's
wait
and see. Absolutely. Nothing like tempting a bit of fate. The issue from my perspective at the moment is not so much one to do with the technicalities of PPPs and PFIs. There are a whole set of issues to do with those that have been going on since 1994 and the beginning of PFI and evolved. It's actually the degree to which it has become re-politicised recently. But before I go on to that, it's worth reminding ourselves that the beginning of the first Labour government, very early on, and if I remember correctly, over the first weekend there was the making the Bank of England independent, and on the Monday when they came back there was the Bates report, obviously our highlight, Bank of England, you know, that's all right, fiddling on the edges, but, you know, let's get the Bates report out because that actually sorts out PFI and then we can get on with the real job. And at that point, there was a lot in there, and if you cast your minds back, there was a log jam around getting hospitals built and all of that. And this really was about starting to make some progress in this area in practical terms. And having been involved, as I have been, with the CBI on the kind of lobby end of this for some time, the consensus view at that time was the political oblique policy debate was largely over. Most of the policy planks that were required, whilst there was some fine-tuning required, have been put in place. But there were huge, and remain huge, implementation issues around workforce issues that Amanda's referred to, around moving a really quite difficult art of taking contracts away from input-based specifications to output-based specifications and taking those in turn further into the levels of kind of flexibility that are required to prevent 180-pound kettles and the like, or at least if they occur, to be able to deal with them flexibly and deal with the evolving situation, that the length of these contracts inevitably put as the real challenge. I said it's become repoliticised, and it has, and I have to say, from a practitioner's point of view, this is just deeply irritating because it's a huge distraction. You know, we hear about the two-tier workforce issue that's been around recently, a wonderful 180-degree switch around from the original charge against PFI at that time, not just PPPs, that... you know, the only way that the likes of us made any money out of these things was by slashing and burning the workers that we took over. We're now told we slash and burn the new workers, not the ones we took over. So, you know, just explain to me again, which one is it? You know, or we'll just slash and burn everybody and have done with it. The pensions issue, you know, the follow-through on that was, again, a very important issue, but a technical issue that the Treasury and others needed to deal with in the terms of how these overall deals were put together. But these are now back into the realms of political debate rather than practical issues, which actually for some years they had been in driving through the evolving art of what the optimum models are. From our point of view, last comment on that, it's also deeply irritating that so many of the headline examples that support this repoliticisation are specific, you know, one instance out of many thousands are... interestingly, often proved inaccurate, and we all, on all sides of this debate, get drawn into, or in my case, try and avoid getting drawn into, the yes, they did, no, they didn't kind of debate over these specifics, rather than focusing on, you know, getting hospitals built or roads built or whatever else. From my perspective, the democratic process is there and allows us to make decisions about the kind of approach we want to these things, whether it is you know, to vote for a party that does or doesn't support PFI or PPP, that does or doesn't have a stance on you know, private involvement in healthcare and so on. And that's what the political process is there to do. Having made those decisions, we're then looking at very practical issues about how you get best value for the public purse. And one of the things that we understand only too well on, you know, one side of the negotiating table is the absolute focus on proving, whether it's against a public sector comparator or what we do elsewhere or whatever other kind of model, what real value for money is, not now, but over the life of the contract. And, you know, it's quite bizarre on occasions trying to think what the net value of assets will be, you know, many years out at the potential kind of handover of a contract at the end of its term. My thesis in this area is there are a lot of deep practical issues that need to be dealt with as we evolve these models. We've willed the ends, we need to look at the means, and the kind of private good, public bad, and vice versa that Amanda refers to not only is unhelpful, it's just deeply misguided. There have always been both public and private involved in any public service, you know. In Victorian times, civil servants didn't make the bricks that built the almshouses. There were always, always private sector involved. The question is a boundary issue. Where do you involve them, to what extent and on what terms? You just buy from them, or do you get better value, the ultimate test, do you get better value for the public purse in public service by a different form of involvement? And there is no magic answer to that. There isn't a formula that says, if you do this, it guarantees it. It's an evolving art, and the early days, and I accept the argument that, you know, the curate's egg argument, absolutely, not all of it is perfect. It's not theologically necessarily right. The early evidence says when you get it right, it represents very good value. But we don't know, is the truth of the matter. There are many years to run in a lot of these big contracts. But given that it's the road we're going down, to repoliticise the debate rather than focus on the practical issues in contracting, I think is absolutely the wrong way to take this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. And then our last, final, but by no means least speaker is Alison Pollock, who's a professor at University College London, one of our sister institutions. Alison was trained as a physician, public health physician in Scotland, and has worked on a number of case studies evaluating PPP and PFI deals in health education, and I think has a, what I can generously describe as a rather more critical view of the subject than those we've heard thus far. But I don't want to set you up too much, Alison. Alison.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me tonight. Feel as if I'm stepping into the lion's den. I don't know how many of you are working on PPPs and PFI. I think the title of this debate was, what was it, short-term salvation versus long-term burden. So I'll start with the long-term burdens, which are now around, well, slightly more than £14 billion worth of PFI schemes signed, committing taxpayers over the next 26 years to £100 billion of tax funding. So that's quite a long-term burden because, of course, these are 30-year contracts and they're tying up future generations, not just ours. So you've heard the term mortgaging the future. And I think this does raise one big key issue, which is the issue about intergenerational equity, which I know LSE is very keen on, the idea of intergenerational equity where, you know, the previous generation gave us benefits which every one of us have experienced. And instead of passing those benefits on to future generations, we're now tying them up into these contracts and actually changing the very constitutional nature and democratic process of our public services. And this leads me into my second issue, which is transparency and accountability. Because one of the major issues for us trying to work in academia on these full business cases is the fact that they're very often not in the public domain. They're concealed under the guise of commercial and confidence, and you can't get the data. In fact, health is probably one of the few areas where you have publicly available data on what's happening to public expenditure and public funds. So there's a real issue about the transparency and accountability and who's got what to hide and why. But I come to the paying for it because these are the short-term consequences. Because the issue of PPPs and PFIs is they're not new money. They're presented by government as new money and new forms of investment, but of course they're not. They're tying up public funds and public taxes. But we've heard about fiscal devolution, but in fact the short-term consequences are they're tying up operating budgets. Because the PPP and PFI payments have to be met from the operating budgets of hospitals, schools, roads, prisons, you name it, public services. So that's where it's being met from. And of course, we all know that private finance is much more expensive than public finance, not least because of the cost of borrowing, but the cost of financing, which we know in health can add up to anything up to 50% of the construction costs. So these are very expensive deals, and the short-term consequence is that it's got to be met from the operating budgets. And we've seen the devastating effects already in health and education. Because what happens is you get an affordability gap emerging, a gap between what the public sector says it can afford and the private sector needs. And what's actually happened in health is a massive shrinkage in capacity. Indeed, since Labour came to power, they've closed 13,000 NHS beds, and we're only now seeing a reversal in this policy. So some of the massive crisis that we have in capacity is directly as a consequence of policies which have included the PFI and led to closure. Indeed, the affordability gap in hospitals has been so great that it's required the diversion of funds from other parts of the service. In Dartford, it required the diversion of funds from mental illness and learning difficulties. In Worcester, it required the closure of another hospital to make these schemes affordable. So it's not just the beds, but it's also the services. But also the government's own management consultants, New Church and Consulting, have estimated that the affordability gap is such that it's required a 25% reduction in staff budgets. So not only are you seeing NHS beds close, but you're seeing reductions in the clinical budgets. And of course, the operating budgets mainly go on staff. So when you put a new pressure on these operating budgets, whether it be for schools or for hospitals, the thing that has to go is staff. And so indeed, we're seeing some imaginative turns of phrase where we're having de-skilling in terms of ward hostesses now instead of nurses was one proposal. Running the, I hope you enjoy having your ward hostess look after you instead of nurses and doctors. And so it's become a major issue because these schemes are so much more unaffordable than people realised that increasingly, not only are they taking out capacity, but large amounts of subsidy are going in for them. In one scheme we looked at in Swindon and Marlborough, the construction cost was £98 million. The total subsidy from the public purse, from land sales, from Treasury, from smoothing loans, the Treasury calls it smoothing loans, came to £72 million. That could have paid for the refurbishment required twice over. But not only that, not only was £72 million of subsidy put up front, but on top of that, the public sector has to find £12 million a year for the next 30 years to run the hospital, just the capital elements of the hospital. So this is hardly a good deal for the public sector. But we're told it's value for money. But of course, the value for money analysis now, as PricewaterhouseCooper, Arthur Anderson, the management consultants, and the government itself now admits, is largely subjective. There is no real science underpinning it, neither the discount rates nor the risk transfer. But the main value for money case hangs on so-called risks transferred. As Charles Cotts has said, these so-called risks are actually ex ante. We still haven't seen the consequences. Can you, in fact, transfer risks from the public to the private sector? And indeed, we have some evidence that we can't, not very successfully. We've already seen what happened with the passport office failure, Siemens, NERS2, the National Insurance Scheme, and, of course, housing benefit schemes, where the national insurance system actually cost the government, the Treasury, and the taxpaying public billions of pounds worth in lost revenues because the scheme went over time, over budget, and was disastrous. And yet the compensation payment fell to about £3.8 million. So in reality, there's a really big question because the value for money case is the sole criteria now that's swinging these schemes. And the reality is the difference between public and private is very marginal. So why would you go along an unevaluated, untested route where you're getting into contracts which are tying the public sector and public purse into 30-year contracts? So the risk transfer case is yet to be proven, but we know that in many schemes they've already gone badly wrong. So I've covered a number of issues because we don't have very long, but if you're really interested in the data, we've done a number of analyses. I wish I had the funding behind my unit that Charles and the CBI have, but if any of you want to donate, then we're very happy. But we don't have either the spin machine or the resources. But we feel we have a public duty to look at these full business cases and look at the data and look at the evidence. So the figures I give to you are based on the empirical evidence that's sitting in the full business cases and the Treasury. So there are real issues now about what we're actually doing to our society and to our whole collective basis of public services and public goods. Because the problem is that when you introduce markets, of course they're competing, they're making competing claims on scarce resources. And that raises real issues because we know that there's nowhere in the world that delivers health or education on the back of for-profit providers, not universally, not to anyone. There never has been and there never is and there never will be because that's the reality, competing motives. So I'm going to end with this issue of intergenerational equity and fairness. Every one of us in this room benefited from the 1948 contract, the contract with the people that gave to us health and education and a number of freedoms from fear. And it gave to us an enormous amount of entitlement. And I think we mustn't relinquish that without a struggle and without a fight. And I'm sorry that Charles thinks that it's unnecessary politicization. but I think it's very necessary that the data, the debate is out there and it's happening. Because this two-tier workforce is a reality. It is actually happening. And the reason why it's only happening to the new workers and not the old workers is because the old workers are currently protected by CHUPI, and Charles knows that full well. But I'm going to put back to you, this is an issue of intergenerational equity. What kind of society do we want to create for ourselves as we grow old, and for our children, and for our children's children? And perhaps some of that vision of 1948 needs to be revisited, because these contracts will have devastating consequences for the population. And maybe we can discuss that.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much, and thank you to all. I'm going to... You itch. I mean, to be fair, I was going to wait. No. I was going to wait until, and I am going to allow each of the speakers an opportunity. But to be fair, as Charles, as it were mentioned by name, if you want in half a minute to respond, and then I'm going to throw it open to the audience.
Perhaps I could point just to two things that we might want to pick up during the course of the debate. You know, the counter argument to the kind of in hoc for the long term is actually not being in hoc for the long term. I don't spend anything, which leaves you with a maintenance problem that we see in schools and hospitals across the country today. Denying that you have an asset and you're prepared to invest in it over generations is foolhardy. Most of us, I suspect, own assets, which if we took that attitude and pass them on to our children as intergenerational. Liabilities, they wouldn't thank us for. So, I'm not for arguing that there are worse or better ways of... Sorry, I am for arguing that there are worse or better ways of doing this, not a theological point on that. And perhaps the other thing is this question of affordability. If it isn't affordable, don't buy it. I'm not in favour of unaffordable contracts.
I mean, I think that neatly brings us to the point where what this all boils down to, it seems to me, is a clear debate about whether the costs of money, or going down the PFI PPP route, whether the costs, the higher cost of borrowing money and the costs of bearing the risk are or are not outweighed by the benefits of improved management and risk transfer. At the nub of this issue is that, if you assume that this is for anything other than getting all these this investment off budget for the government, and I'm just assuming politely that it isn't all about keeping it off budget. Right, now, we have a roving microphone, and it would be nice if you could keep statements or questions to a minimum. They can be questions, of course, to any member of the panel, or if you feel impelled to make some kind of statement to correct something or argue, please do, but try and keep them short. So, and as ever, if you could broadly indicate where, other than the LSE, you're from, it would be a good thing. Now, yep, question here, and then a second one.
Yes, my name's Anthony Sykes. I work for a bank involved in the sector. And clearly, the pricing of the finance, the cost of the finance we're talking about, is purely and simply a question of the pricing of the risk that's involved. Nobody disputes the fact if the UK government goes out and borrows money, it's going to be much cheaper, but you're not pricing any risk in that. It's risk-free. So clearly the price that we charge for the money takes on board the risks that that our borrower is assuming. So clearly it's not a question of the private sector somehow extracting benefit from a deal which shouldn't really be there. This intergenerational transfer we're talking about, I think, is an issue of whether the voting public actually wants its infrastructure now as opposed to tomorrow. If it wants it now, then clearly it has to pay for it. I think Charles was mentioning that point. So I doubt whether we'd actually be very happy to live with our schools and hospitals in their current state. And that leads me back to Professor Pollock's point about this so-called transfer of risk. If the roof of the hospital falls in and it's privately managed, the private sector is obliged to replace it at its own cost. Now, what happens under the current system is that it's patched up. Basically, nothing is done because the money's not available. So I do think there's a profound difference both in the lifetime management of the assets concerned, but I don't think that that necessarily is reflected in the... extortionate rate of interest that's being charged for the financing.
Can I just ask, if the risk is full, if this worked theoretically correctly, and the risk was perfectly and fully calculated and built into the bidding costs. I'm not wholly sure I fully understand why it would make any difference in the long term. If it was perfectly done, wouldn't it simply be the same to the public sector, because the private sector would price the risk in a way that means in the end the long-term cost of the public sector would have been the same as if it stayed in the public sector?
Well, risks are supposed to be borne by the party best able to bear them.
Right.
And they will price them cheaper. So one man's risk is not the same as another.
And so the presumption is that in the deal, that the risk will be split between the public and the private sector in the best possible way. Is that right? Well, I'll just leave that one floating, because I'm sure all our speakers will want to come back on that issue, and I may want to bring them in. Anybody else want to pick this particular point up? Yes, the chap next door.
Howard Webb. I also work in the city for an organisation called the Housing Finance Corporation. I just want to follow on the point that Charles Cox raised about...
So can you speak up?
The point that Charles Cox raised about if the deal isn't affordable, don't do it. I think the problem there is that the decision-making process is slightly rigged. We have an interesting situation in the housing market where private finance has probably been in existence for a lot longer, where there are large-scale stock transfers of local authority housing to newly established housing associations. And in those circumstances, the actual decision is subject to a vote by the end user, the tenants. And what we've had there is a range of different decisions. In some cases, the tenants have voted for, in other cases, against. Recently, Birmingham, they voted against, despite the fact that there was a very large carrot of private finance being offered in terms of investment in their homes, but they chose to remain in the public sector.
And Glasgow voted in favour, didn't it? So, I mean, it is but interesting to wonder whether they were getting the risk calculation absolutely right in making that collective decision, but thank you for that.
Can I just come back on this, Charles? I just want to come back to this issue about don't buy it if you can't afford it, because you've all heard of Tina, there is no alternative, and the only show in town, the only game in town. It's been a political decision. That's why it needs to be politicised, this debate, not to make public capital available. Indeed, public capital in the NHS has fallen into negative figures. So it's a political decision, though there have been plenty of surpluses, as the Treasury people will tell you, not to make public capital available, so this is the only alternative. So hospitals and schools have completely had their hands tied. I'd like to deal with the maintenance, but we can come back to that.
Okay, fine. Thanks.
One point on the costs of all of this. If you look at the cost of a unit of output, I realise it's not always possible to be really clinically clear about what that is, but if you look at the cost of a unit of output, and through a deal, including the risk transfer premium, that is lower, and in many of the contracts, it isn't just a gamble that it's lower, it's baked into the contract that it will be lower, and decreasing further over time. Now, you can argue that government money might have been cheaper than private money, and it's prima facie a true statement. But it wasn't the public money that was available, and you're not just buying money and then buying other things. There's a whole set of ingredients to do with resources and skills and money and so on, which come together to deliver a value of output. And if you can get an output that's valued as improved in whatever value you want and costs less, I think then to bring to the fore the argument about the cost of money is misleading at best.
Amanda.
Sort of a couple of points on the affordability question. I think there's a difference between perception and reality in terms of whether PFI PPP is the only game in town. This is often something that's said, but if you look at the figures, PFI as a proportion of total public investment is still pretty small. It's certainly under 20%, certainly in local government, and I think the figures are pretty similar in central. And I think also there's an interesting spin-off from PFI PPP in terms of improving the government's planning process. After decades of capital starvation, when any public official had an idea about a project, they'd go in and say, we can have this fantastic project, it'll be so good and it won't cost very much. And then quite often, under conventional procurement, the truth of the situation only really emerged after the deal was signed and projects ran over budget, not just initial the capital investment, but also maintenance budgets were slashed because of the consequence of all of this. And the handy thing about PPP is it's kind of brought all of these things into discussion during the procurement phase. And it's right that hospital bed numbers have been reduced over the course of the procurement, but that often was a result of unrealistic expectations at the outset from the client. And the beauty about PPP is that it actually tries to get a much more robust deal from the outset. And also, just to pick up the point about intergenerational equity, you know, over the past sort of 15 years or so, we've treated future generations pretty shabbily if you start adding up the backlog maintenance. You know, that's why we're in such a crisis now, because it didn't happen. And again, one of the spin-offs of PFI PPP is it started to make people realise that whether you do these things conventionally or whether you do them through PPP, it's not good enough simply to say, let's just build the prison, let's just build the school, let's just build the hospital, and then we won't really worry about whether we've got a maintenance budget, especially if we need to make a tax cut in the run-up to an election.
Bob. I think it's interesting that we are having quite a political debate, in fact, although probably a number of people prefer that that wasn't the case. And having acknowledged that, I'm inclined very much to Charles's view on a number of these specifics, because at the end of the day, the end user out there does not have any theological view about PPP one way or the other. Joe Public, my constituents, don't really care, I suspect, who actually owns the tube, but they do want the ruddy thing to turn up on time and actually want to see certain specific deliverables achieved in terms of that public service, same as they would with their hospital, same as they would with their school. So provided we bear in mind that PPPs are a tool and not an end in themselves, then I think there's a perfectly legitimate point to say that if they give better value for money, then we shouldn't be afraid to embrace them. That's where I part company with Alison in the idea that we should therefore assume that the contract of 1948 can only be delivered by the means that existed in 1948. Yet the technology has moved on, I'm happy to accept, in terms of financing, just as it has in virtually every other walk of life. But what we do have equally to be aware of is that it shouldn't become this rather arcane economic debate. We do have to have this very rigid test, which isn't always applied, as to what is actually delivered for the punters at the end of the day. And I think we also have to bear in mind that one of the difficulties when we talk about intergenerational transfers and so on is the very short-term nature, historically, of budgeting in the public sector. And we need to act to do our bit within the public sector, it seems to me, to move away from that culture in which, you know, 3 years deal, which was just done for road maintenance in London in terms of guaranteeing the finance for TfL, that's a big deal. That's actually a major step forward that we've wrested out of the mayor. It's actually, when you think of it, pretty minuscule. And that just indicates where we're starting from. And until we get that bit right, then I think we'll be slightly sort of arguing in the dark as far as it's concerned.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, there's a question here, but there was one over there. But gentleman here.
Traditionally, it's said that the public sector does the right things, while the private sector does things right. And you know, and one way, I presume, the theoretical argument of doing PPP type deals was to actually marry the two comparative advantages. But unfortunately, it seems to me the way the PPP is being implemented in Britain, it stands this on its head. Because, just to take the example of the most famous example of the tube, the reason the private sector does things right is because of the accountability through the market that is built in through customers. I mean, that's the reason the private sector seems to be more efficient. But unfortunately, when you have information requirements and contracts of the way that you see that which is being done, what you're going to end up is diluting the incentives even further. And so, you know, you'll end up not achieving, in fact, worsening the efficiency that you could achieve in the public sector. Conversely, on the case of the public sector, it seems to me that PPP possibilities and city choices seem to be determining the choices of what gets to be done, at least distorting them at the margin. So it seems to me that instead of being a synergistic situation, it's exactly the opposite. I'm surprised that none of you have addressed the implementation and contractual sort of problems that exist in the present setup.
I mean, when you say problems of the kind, give us a sort of for instance.
For instance, the London Tube. I mean, if you, any reasonable person, at least I've not looked at the documents, but all that you...
Too many of them, I suspect.
Too many of them. And if not just that, the sorts of problems, and incidentally, this sort of experience is there in much simpler situations in other parts of the world, where much simpler, much less complex things have run into bigger problems than people have been talking about here. And complexity sort of grows exponentially.
I mean, I'll ask our sort of two broad proponents. I fear that the PPP for the Tube, in a sense, is the, even for many PFI PPP folk, the exception that proves the rule. So I wouldn't want to sort of blame them, expect them to carry the can for it. But do you want to carry the can for it? Or?
No, not particularly.
Right.
I think it's a good example of where, in terms of understanding what you're trying to get and why you're trying to get it, has become completely shrouded in all the kind of political and financial debate and manoeuvring. One of the things, just the point that I was going to make earlier, that is sadly the case in certainly the majority of situations that I've had to deal with, and that actually isn't the Tube, is that when you go in to start the kind of due diligence in preparation for a contract negotiation, what you find is people haven't a clue what they've got, they haven't a clue how much it costs, how many people are involved in doing it, and even just the discipline of going through a tender process, if they were not to let a contract, would have served a purpose in most instances. And certainly the ability to be able to look at, I mean, one of the reasons that Amanda said rightly that the CBI take a view that there isn't, you know, we're not just pro-PPP and PFI, it's the right horse for the right course. It's only really when you get into some of the structures and dynamics that you really do determine whether there's the chance to create extra value. And if there isn't, distorting it, whether it's for political reasons or any other reasons, is not going to lead to a successful deal. And that helps nobody. It doesn't help the supplier and it doesn't help the service user.
Okay, well, it's the PPP for the Tube, right? Got two more, three more, four more, five more. Right, good. Chap at the back there, and then two, and that. Then we'll just sort of come down and move back. Yes.
Christopher Boyle, Azra Housing Association. My question to the panel is that the much proclaimed benefit of PPP might not necessarily be available to the less lucrative areas of service delivery. That's my question and that's my concern.
Less lucrative areas, meaning that there would be parts of the public service that were incapable either... for whatever reason, to produce an income stream that would repay, is that all for political or other reasons?
That would repay as well as attracting PPP. Mm. PPP would stay away from certain areas.
Alison, something that you've, other areas of, I know you're generically unenthusiastic, but are there some areas that you're, there's some sense in which some areas would be
I'm
completely
sure
off?
I'm sure the modernisation can answer that question.
I think if you ask yourself, well, where is PPP going to work? It's going to work where there is a private sector capability, a good, strong public sector client, and where the risks are largely operational rather than political. So let's take the example of prisons. the risks in prison contracts on kind of mainland GB are certainly operational, and we have some very good prison contracts in the UK, in England, and maybe some in Scotland and Wales too, I'm not sure. But we've got very good, you know, contracts, prison contracts, where the PFI deal has been described as the jewel in the prison service crime. You wouldn't think about having a PFI deal in Northern Ireland for prisons, because the risks are very political. And if you were going to have that kind of approach, then you'd also need to be in a situation where you were building up market capacity over time. I think there are interesting kind of quiet little examples of PPP approaches. Never hit the headlines. Working Links in Brent, doing a great job to find people jobs and keep them in jobs. You know, I wrote the figures down earlier, but, you know, like two or three times the number of people staying in jobs after 3 months if they've gone through Working Links than if they had just found a job from the local jobs market. There's a very good business improvement district thing going on in Coventry, where you get a successful service kind of running the city centre, and at the same time really good business input into council decision making. These kind of deals just don't hit the headlines. You might not think of them as particularly lucrative, but what they have done is matched an imaginative public sector client with innovative private sector expertise, and where there has been scope just to do things differently. And actually doing those things differently has generated huge service improvements.
Okay, thank you.
I was just going to add one point to that. I mean, I think there is a general, it's a general truth, and you know, people aren't going to go. We would not go into areas that aren't worth it. But actually, part of the dynamic of that is looking at, for example, brigading school maintenance deals together, and looking at where what you have to do to make them marketable in that sense. And again, I would, you know, part of my thesis would be that examination to see what it is in itself, irrespective of the outcome of it, is valuable. It's breaking down kind of preconceived barriers about how things might be done and how things might be handled in a way that is more rather than less likely to improve public value, whether it results in a PPP or not.
Right. Now, there was some question here, and then there's another one, and then one, and then chap here.
My name is Sadat. I just graduated from the LSE last year and working in the city at the moment. My question was specifically for Professor Pollock.
Can you hear at the back? No. Can you either hold it closer, switch it on, shout?
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Sorry.
I am working at the city at the moment, and my question was specifically for Professor Pollock. If I understood her comments correctly, then it all boils down to risk sharing and how subjective it is and the discounting factors of it. My question to you is this. The private sector is a specialist, or the private sector is specialist in pricing risk and managing risk. They have the swap curves, and they have swap curves that go up to 30 years and 40 years, or any amount of time as you might think of. Whereas on the other hand, there is no such mechanism in the public for the government. There's no market. The second factor is that, as you're pointing out, that there would that the debt market would be charging a much higher premium for funding any public project, as you're pointing out. But I don't really see why that would be the case, because debt capital market is not the place where banks make their money from. The margins in Europe are such that it will be pretty much the same as any public funding that would come in the area. Banks make their money in marginal acquisitions or some other advisory business. So I don't really follow your argument that the market would misprice and market would take a much larger cut than what would be provided from the public sector. The only other point I wanted to make was, finally, it comes down to the discounting factor and the pricing of risk, and I just do not understand how the public sector would be able to come up with the correct pricing of risk. And I would just be interested to find out exactly what you think on this.
Well, you've asked me questions about the value for money analysis, which in all academic circles, including LSE, is under challenge and debate. I mean, the first issue is discounting and the use of discounting and the rate at which the discount rate is set. which social welfare economists like David Ulph and others have said is far too high. So that's the first thing. So there's a real issue about the use of discount rate and what it's for, and then where it should be set. And the second issue is about the so-called risk transferred. And as we all know, there's no science behind you. You make great claims for the science behind the risk transfer, but I've yet to see a well-laid-out methodology or scientific evaluation of so-called risks. And most of those risks are either unidentifiable. For instance, the Value for Money Drivers report that Arthur Anderson and LSE Enterprise did, it shows in half of the schemes you couldn't even identify the so-called risk transferred. And most of those risks were actually construction cost risks during the design phase, not the 30 phase of the contract, that could have been managed with penalty clauses. And the other thing that they found was the high proportion of costing of risk as a proportion of the construction cost and the enormous variation and variability. So this all begins to shed doubt on this so-called science. But the real issue is that these risk calculations are ex ante. They do inflate the price, but we don't know yet what the real risks will be and where they will be born and where they will be really held. I thought it was very interesting. We heard that the prisons, you wouldn't dream of having a prison in Northern Ireland because the risks are too strong, i.e. the risks revert back to the public sector, which is best able to bear it. And we've already seen that in many of the schemes. So that's to deal with the VFM. And there are very comprehensive academic critiques that I commend you to. I think the Treasury would also point you in the right direction. I just want to come back to this issue of contracts, because these are 30-year contracts which are ring-fenced and guaranteed, and if you change them, there's a real issue. But already, yesterday I had a phone call on education PFIs, and some of these PFIs, because they're so expensive, the LEAs and the school governors are signing contracts for only less than 270 days a year. So what happens when schools, for example, want to introduce summer schools or increase the number of days that they teach? They have to go back and negotiate that with the SPV. But as well as that, community groups are now reporting that whereas the community groups were able to use these facilities for ethnic minorities, for extra language teaching, all the things that we want in our society, they're now finding that these contracts are actually the private sector is charging them so much because it no longer sees them as a public good but a commercial necessity, and so that these community groups are actually being turned away and not being able to use these schools anymore. And this is a major issue. So there can be all sort, not only do the contracts make issues inflexible and there are real issues about changes and what happens then to the cost of these contracts, but there can all be all sorts of other ramifications that we don't actually think about because we can't actually predict. So in that case, for these special schools on Saturdays, the communities are bearing the risks because they can't use those schools and they can't afford to use them. So the risks actually pass back to the individuals who can't get access to education, the teachers who can't teach them, and the communities at large.
Okay, now I want to pick up two more quick questions, or three, and because I want to try and finish on time. So... because it's been answered, or because you've lost the will to ask it? Okay.
Yeah. I got a better one.
I mean, it's rather delayed now. It's about sort of politicisation of PPP, but and this is very much directed at you, Robert Neil. But it seems the only time
quite well so far.
The public has, or the time at which the public has most seriously been asked about PPP was during the mayor elections, where it seemed to me Ken Livingstone was basically standing on the platform of do not privatise the tube and got the biggest landslide majority of almost any politician in the history of British politics, in my memory at any rate. And then there was the situation with Railtrack, and you yourself say this is the one issue with which you probably agree with Ken Livingstone. In the face of all of this, how does the government go about determining a policy where you have PPP on the tube? I mean, how, in the face of such large public opposition, how do you formulate a policy? It just seems extraordinary.
I think if I were the government, I wouldn't be formulating that policy, as you've gathered. I actually think the government has got it wrong as far as this one is concerned, but I actually think Tony's point is right, that you shouldn't judge the whole principle by this particular deal. As far as the Livingston situation is concerned, not sure I quite go with you on the size of the mandate. I think there are other political historians here not a million miles away who might help you on that. But it is a fact that you didn't just have Ken Livingston say, I'm opposed to the PPP. You had Steve Norris, who actually ran him, I think, quite a credible result, saying, OK, I'm not averse to the principle, but we wouldn't necessarily do it this way. And I think there is a danger, because it is political, I agree to that extent, that it has to be taken on board, that if governments are so blinkered about going down a particular system for almost what seems to me, as far as the Treasury on this one is concerned, a very theological view rather than a practical one, that doesn't meet the criteria that I was referring to at the beginning, that does it actually deliver for the end user within a sort of a sensible, meaningful term. And secondly, it runs the danger of discrediting what is a useful tool. But a tool is something that there ultimately has to be a political decision as to whether it's appropriate to use it or not. And that comes back to the gentleman's point at the back. And I can think of some instances where it won't be appropriate to use the tool. The only other thing I would say, though, is to echo Charles's point that nonetheless, sometimes the process can be valuable. In fact, my first involvement was chairing the Environment Committee in London Borough of Havering. When we went through a tendering process about our refuse collection, we decided as a political decision that we weren't, in fact, going to an outright privatisation there. But I still got, you know, significant couple of million plus savings for the revenue budget as a result of the exercise. So that was worthwhile. But it is all about coming back to the question then about a measure of common sense and pragmatism in how you apply.
Okay, now I've promised Charles has got to leave sharply, so I'm going to give all the speakers a brief opportunity to sum up, but there were two outstanding questions. If they can be asked very, very short, short questions, chap at the back there, and there was one other. That's it.
Hello, yeah, I'm. My name's Joe Ross, I'm a retired local government accountant. Just two points, really. One for Alison, the intergenerational gap. If the project lasts as long as the financing, the generations paying will be the generations using, I would have thought. And secondly, one for Charles. Does he think the interest cost of deals would be higher due to the Transport Secretary's making or having made Railtrack insolvent?
That's a very... I like that one. That's a very good question perhaps to ask. Now, I can't even remember what reverse order was, actually. Can you hold on, or do you...
Go ahead.
Alison, can I ask, as you were last speaker,
yes,
to be the first to
conclude? Yes, it's you're doing. It's really what you're doing in the process, because we're being left with private finance as the only alternative, the only show in town. But in the process, because it's so expensive, there's actually even there's a short-term downsizing in services and services available. We see that in education, we see that in health. And so, and one of the issues where the government in its recent review of the NHS plan last week has already introduced mechanisms for user charges. So this goes hand in hand with a parcel of reforms which will shrink down the size of the public sector and the public sphere and create mechanisms for user charges, which is actually what private finance works best off, is user charges. So you're actually changing the very nature of public services in doing so in all sorts of ways that we haven't been able to explore, constitutional, democratic, financial, and in terms of passing the burden of risks away from us collectively to individuals.
Thank you very much. Charles? And don't forget Railtrack.
Railtrack wasn't a PPP, it was privatisation, and I think we need to keep these things quite distinct in the way we think about them.
The question, to be fair, was will it put the cost of the deals up, regardless of what the original intent was?
No, I don't believe it will, because people look at the risk transfer on their merits. You know, I'm involved in a number of these deals right now. It has had not one penny piece difference on the financing charges to the ones that I'm doing. If it's in that sector and it's addressing some of the risks that are now perhaps more explicit as a result, then it may do. But as a general statement, I don't believe it does. In fact, I know on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't. Sorry? Transport projects and related...
Charles, I mean... Why did all those people from the city sign sort of a rather kind of aggravated letter to the Chancellor about this, which was given much publicity? I mean, wasn't there a letter from the city saying it's all going to be more expensive from now on, we need comfort? So there is something behind this question.
Well, I think this has to do with equity financing, and it's not an area that I'm particularly expert in, so I'm not, there are people in the audience far better equipped to answer that particular question than I am. But if I can just come back on two points, I don't want to kind of sum up in the round, but there are two points. Much has been made about the expensive contracts that are apparently out there. If what is being bought has a lower unit cost of delivery for a service, I don't understand what expensive means. If there are expensive ingredients in it, there could be expensive money as an ingredient, there could be expensive materials, there could be expensive people. If those ingredients together produce a lower service cost for an improved service, that has got to be good value. And I think an argument to the contrary is fallacious. I'm sorry? Well, then you're into... yes, OK, we can open the whole topic up again about risk transfer and what happens at the event of... at the end of a contract. And it isn't only when providers go broke, you provide for the exit from a contract. But I'm sorry, I was trying to sum up, not reopen the debate.
It's one to pursue over a drink in a minute.
OK. The other thing was the talk about risk. And you're right, it's not a science in the kind of Newtonian sense of science, but there's a great deal of analysis and construction. I can speak for my own business, where we have a kind of 30-page analytic spreadsheet used to work out all the various dimensions of risk in a contract that we're going into, which varies deal to deal to deal to deal, depending on the current and past performance of deals and other factors, as well as the specifics for for that deal. It isn't a science in the true sense, but it's not guesswork, and it looks very closely at how you achieve best value. Remember, it's a competitive environment. Remember, there are other comparators. And, you know, by walking in and saying, well, we can just do it better, just doesn't do it. So there is a market effect there and a lot of analysis behind it. If those two things don't do it for you, don't play the game, is my view.
Okay, thanks very much. And, quite evening for politicians, really. All these experts...
But it makes a nice change of this, from us squabbling around the experts, I suppose, well, I'd say. But I think it is interesting, having quite a measure of consensus, certainly around the value of it as a tool. There is that broad political debate that you have to have, and in many ways, in response to the last question, I think I've broadly set out where my stall is as far as that's concerned, so I won't hold the time. But I do think, just to reinforce the point, that it is a valuable tool, but... that's not any excuse for us avoiding the other part of the debate, which is it's a tool which I believe that would work more effectively if we had a more diverse means of procuring major public sector projects, and that involves us being prepared to move away from the very highly centralised form of controls that we have over public financing, and particularly over the democratically accountable element of local government in the UK at the moment from central government.
And Amanda.
Fine. The government has a very clear responsibility to current and future generations, and also to the sustainability of the economy in the long term. And it's got to address that responsibility by getting kind of two questions right. One is, what do we want? And how are we going to get it? And it's important not to confuse those two issues. So the what do we want is, you know, the government starting to think as a client. You know, do we want to be in a situation where we want community groups coming in to use schools at the weekend? Do we want to be in a situation where we charge and reduce the cost of maintaining the school? That's a government client decision. The government has to take those decisions responsibly and then make sure that, as with everything else, that it gets best value for money in going about that. And just to, you know, kind of end where I began, this is not because it's private good, public bad. It's because having a range of different ideas, different providers, and a kind of healthy competitive pressure will motivate others to do better. You see that particularly in prisons, for example. The PFI prisons have certainly encouraged the prison service to sharpen up its own act, and now it's kind of moving ahead again. And it's very important that the government behaves as a very strong client, motivating the best of the public and private sectors to deliver. In terms of value for money, I think we need to get the discussion as much on service quality issues as on cost issues, and try to understand why and where and how you get better service quality. Get that more into the public domain. But I kind of leave the last word with the National Audit Office, who conducted a thorough study into 100 PFI projects. They spoke to public sector clients, they spoke to private sector partners, they also spoke to some service users, and the vast majority of the public sector people said, we think we're getting excellent or good or satisfactory value for money. There were only 2% of the public sector clients who thought they weren't getting satisfactory value for money. And a 98% success rate provides us hope for the future.
Thank you all very much for summing up succinctly, and indeed for speaking in the 5 to 7 minute slots that I originally invited you to. It's interesting listening to the debate, and thank you all for your contributions, and I'm sorry for those who didn't quite get in with their question. Fascinating thing about the debate about PFIs and PPPs, and Bob Neil hinted at this, is that it's become strangely ideological at a time when ideology has been significantly removed from British politics. So the debate about whether or not to construct the, or to go ahead with major public projects and finance and control and oversee them in one way rather than another has become a matter of enormous ideological struggle in a political system where ideological struggle is generally at its least for a very long time. And linking that curiosity to the fact that this may well be a surrogate for a debate about how we control public expenditure and the most appropriate way to allow decisions to be made by non-central institutions. Many of them might well choose to use PFI, PPB, given the freedom. Others might do it by more traditional routes, but at the moment the choices are limited. And I suppose that this leads me to my final thought from the chair, which is that the answer to whether or not this is an appropriate way of doing things, whether or not this is better value for money and a better way of delivering projects or worse, will be whether it turns out to be a long-term solution, whether Britain is still using this method of facilitating major new public sector infrastructure projects, whether it's still doing it in this way in 5, 10, 15 years' time, or if it turns out to have been a fashion. Only time will tell. On your behalf, I'd like to thank our four speakers who have so valiantly put forward their views in a fairly complex, what is undoubtedly a rather complex area, riddled with jargon and terms that I certainly don't fully understand. And I'd like to, before you give them a round of applause, just say you're all very welcome to come up to the fifth floor, to the senior dining room, for a drink and a peanut and no doubt an LSE Twiglets. Thank you all for coming, and thank our speakers.